kulam. Hello, everyone. We are going to start the shiur now. I hope everyone can hear me. Okay. I know that Rabbi Kelman is here with us, which is great. And I would like to start today's shiur. Obviously, today's shiur is with the background of the past few days, Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaTzma'ut. Those special days are in the background of today's shiur. And I would like to address the unique halachic questions that we have regarding the Israeli army. I mentioned last week that having a Jewish state created new questions. Rabbis were required to reinvent halachic concepts, halachic ideas. They had to look into the past to find precedents in Jewish law that somehow can relate to the new questions and the new challenges that the Jewish state created. No different was the Israeli army. With the finding of the Israeli army, the IDF, Tzahal in 1948, again, new questions came up, new challenges. Rav Shlomo Goren, then the chief rabbi of Israel, writes in his autobiography how he was required to create yesh me'ayin, new halachot. He said that the Shulchan Aruch really doesn't talk about these kind of questions. The situation, the scenarios, the dilemmas that came up are not discussed in the classic books of halacha. And he needed to use a lot of imagination and a lot of his vast knowledge to create new halachic criteria, definitions, phrases, concepts, rules to allow him to rule in halachic questions that came up in the Israeli army. Today, I would like to focus on one or two questions which are may not be. Perhaps they're not really such famous or well-known questions, but I believe that the discussion of these questions will help us understand certain dilemmas, problems that we have regarding the IDF and the challenges of Jewish law. And I'm referring to the status of Kohanim in the Israeli army. I'll begin the shiur with a story that my father, Rav Binyamin Tabori, Alav HaShalom, some of you, I'm sure in Toronto, knew him. My father was once very shocked when one of his students, in following the Second Lebanon War, in the year 2006, came to my father with the following question. Now, it's fair, we have to say the truth. The question wasn't asked before the events occurred. Actually, after the war, the student spoke to my father and shared with him the following story. He said to him that they were a group of Israeli soldiers in the Second Lebanon War, stuck in Lebanon. You probably remember that there were a lot of fashlut, as we say in Hebrew, in the Lebanon War, a lot of problems. Israel wasn't really prepared so well for this, for the war there. And there were a lot of mistakes were made. Let's leave it with that. This group of soldiers were under attack. They were in battle and their officer was killed. They called for a helicopter evacuation for the body. And they were told that due to certain circumstances that it was too dangerous, the helicopter will not be able to enter their area, and they will have to carry their officer back to Israel on a stretcher. That's it. No help is coming their way. So they took a stretcher. They opened the stretcher. And he said to my father, and he explained to my father that they were a group of soldiers, 8 to 10 soldiers. And the truth is that they didn't really need every one of them, meaning he didn't have to necessarily carry the stretcher, but he explained he really wanted to because this was his officer. So what was the problem? The problem was that he was a Kohen. And we know that one of the restrictions of a Kohen is not to come in contact with a dead body. So it's true that if a Kohen finds a met mitzvah, if a Kohen meets up with a body where there's no one to take care of the body, and this body is therefore classified as a met mitzvah, then the halacha is very clear that a Kohen is allowed to take care of the body and to bury the body because of the special halacha of a met mitzvah. However, in this case, the soldier explained to my father that wasn't the case. There were other soldiers there. They could have carried him. They could have taken care of him. It was, however, his interest, he felt so emotional about how his officer was lying there that he wanted to participate in carrying his body back to Israel. And he wasn't sure what to do. He really was very confused whether or not, under the circumstances, it would be allowed to him, would be permitted for him to be metame, come in contact and carry his commander back to Israel. Before I continue, I just want to emphasize here that look at these kind of questions that Israeli soldiers sometimes are dealing with. These kind of questions were not dealt with for 2,000 years. When in the halachic literature do we have such a question? Maybe in other circumstances, but such a sensitivity that a soldier who is a frum soldier is aware of both of the halacha and wishes to keep the halacha, but at the same time is involved in fighting for his country. I find these types of questions overwhelming and very unique to what Tzahal is all about. Let's go back to the story. So my father was very touched by this Shaila, and he discussed it with many people and different Rabbanim. The conclusion was, of my father at least, I think his gut feeling was that it was permitted. I'm not going to go right now into the whole discussion about met mitzvah, if when is allowed, when is not allowed. I'm not so interested in the conclusion of this halakha. Rather, it serves as an introduction to our shiur today, which is how halakha in the army is a very sensitive matter, which creates questions which were not discussed in the past. And at the same time, it really brings in the unique halachic position of status of a Kohen into the discussion. And I'll explain what I mean, that the Kohen here is a key model, a key figure here in our shiur today. In First World War, there were many questions that were discussed by Poskim whether or not Jewish Kohanim are allowed to go to war. Now you can say, what do you mean, are they allowed? There was a draft. Who asked them this question? The answer is, it was actually asked. The chief rabbi at the time of the United Kingdom of Great Britain, at that time it surely was the British Empire, he was asked this question. Rabbi Hertz, the chief rabbi, was asked whether or not he encourages, by the British Army, by the British government, he was asked whether or not he would permit for the Jewish community to draft their priests. Now, when I read this, when I read the tshuva about the priest, I really was wondering, and I wonder if people have any insight to this, when the British government asked this question, do they mean priests per se? Do they mean Kohanim? Do they mean men of the rabbis? It's very interesting to me what they really meant, but Rabbi Hertz referred in his answer to the Kohanim. He translated the priests into Kohanim, and he argued that Kohanim are allowed to go to battle, are allowed to go to war. And he discussed the issue that we are discussing right now about how can a Kohen come in contact with dead bodies. Surely a Kohen fighting in a war is going to, at some point, going to come into this question. At some point, he will be facing a dead body, and we know that Kohanim cannot touch dead bodies. And this was one of the issues that he addressed in his tshuva. At the time, by the way, there were many other rabbis that talked about this question. Many of them permitted the Kohanim to go to war. It's interesting to note that at the time, the chief rabbi of Belfast, who later on became very well known, Rav Herzog, later on the chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Herzog at the time being in Belfast, actually argued against Rav Hertz, and he argued that Kohanim should not be drafted to the British Army. So one of the issues in front of us was the question of Tumat Kohanim, the question of how can a Kohen come in contact with the dead. The other question that also was brought up and discussed actually in great length was the question regarding Birkat Kohanim. Meaning, the Gemara tells us that a Kohen who was involved in killing someone is not allowed to do Birkat Kohanim. I want to share with you a source sheet here that brings these sources. Please follow, if you can please look at source number 5. The Rambam tells us explicitly based upon the Gemara that there are certain factors that prevent a Kohen from reciting Birkat Kohanim. And one of them, a Kohen who killed someone should never recite the priestly blessings, even if he repents. And the Shulchan Aruch in source number 6 agrees to this idea. And he says, Kohen sharagita nefesh afilu b'shogeg. If a Kohen kills someone, even by mistake, not on purpose, lo yisa it kapav afilu asa tshuva. The Rama adds, v'yesh umrim de'im asa tshuva nose kapav. The Rama actually disagrees and says, perhaps if someone repents, he's still allowed to do birkat kohanim. V'yesh lehakel al ba'alei tshuva lo linol do del bifnem v'hachi nahug. The Rama really says that the minhag is that if someone kills someone and does tshuva, we allow him to do birkat kohanim. This idea that a kohen who's involved in killing someone is not allowed to do birkat kohanim is based upon source number 4. The Gemara in Masechet Brachot, Rabbi Yochanan said, please follow with me, a Kohen who has killed someone may not raise his hands, since it says, when you spread your hands, I will ignore you. Your hands have been filled with blood. Now, what's interesting is that someone might argue with me, this kind of source seems to indicate that if a Kohen kills someone intentionally, a murderer, then it would make sense. However, we're talking about battle. Would the halacha be any different when a Kohen would be in a battle and killing someone based in a way that's permitted? Would that make any difference? Before I answer that question, I want to explain that I think what bothered the rabbis at the time of World War I was that they saw the Kohen as the exact opposite figure than the character of a soldier. I think that's what the Gemara is also trying to tell us. The Gemara is telling us that a Kohen is a man of peace. Who was the ultimate Kohen? Aaron HaKohen. Ohev Shalom, Rodef Shalom, Ohev et HaBriot, Mekarvan LaTorah, Aaron, the great Kohen, the Kohen HaGadol, the ultimate model of a priest, of a Kohen, was a man of peace. And surely a Kohen who killed someone is doing exactly the opposite, and therefore loses his position, and therefore he loses the ability to bless the Jewish people. And in World War I, when the rabbis were discussing this question about Kohanim serving in the armies at the time of Europe, they really conveyed their feelings and their thoughts that maybe this would be a problem, not just a technical problem, because a Kohen who comes back from battle would not be allowed to perform Birkat Kohanim, rather because it's against the whole figure, the whole character of what a Kohen stands for. Nevertheless, many of the poskim at the time, not only did they allow Kohanim to participate in war, they also permitted the Kohanim, when they returned from battle, to do Birkat Kohanim. Some poskim argued that, firstly, they said Kohanim that come back from war are not always very sure and very clear that they actually kill someone. More so, they said the Kohen who the Gemara is talking about is a Kohen who does it either on purpose or by mistake, but surely is not doing it in the heat of battle, which is already a permissible act. And so far, so they argued different arguments to permit the Kohanim to do Birkat Kohanim. One of these poskim, much later on, obviously after World War I, was Rav Moshe Feinstein, and I am I'm going back to the source sheet. As you can see, Rav Moshe Feinstein in source number 7 talks about a Kohen who fought in battle. Uvidvar Kohen shinilkach latzava be'et ha-milchama v'harag nefashot ba-milchama pashut shekasher lisa kapav. Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's pashut, it's simple, that a Kohen who comes back from a war is permitted to do Birkat Kohanim. Deha mefurash be'ansu laharog shenose kapav. Interestingly, Rav Moshe explains that a person who is forced to kill someone is obviously not under the category of a Kohen who's not permitted to Birkat Kohanim. Now, I find that interesting because Rav Moshe Feinstein is talking about a Kohen who is fighting in World War I, maybe World War II. He was not referring to the Kohen of the IDF, of Tzahal, a concept that he wasn't very familiar with. And he was talking about a soldier who is drafted against his will to another country's army, and he argued that in those circumstances, a person who is forced to kill someone is allowed to do Birkat Kohanim. Fascinating is Rav Avadia's tshuva. Rav Avadia Yosef, chief rabbi of Israel, is one of the only rabbis that I know of who actually addressed this question regarding Tzahal. This is not First World War, and this is not Rav Moshe Feinstein. This is already a tshuva written specifically for Chayalei Tzahal. And Rav Avadia, in source number 8, tells us the following. He says, he quotes the idea that Rav Moshe discussed, that if someone is forced to kill someone, he's permitted. Kal vachomer, said Rav Avadia, kol sheken. Shakoanim shem chayalei tzahal omdim legonen al Yisrael ve'al artzenu hakdosha en safek shemitzvah rabba hem osim lekadem pnei tzvaot haoyev habaim lizroa heres ulashmid ularog ulabed. Said Rav Avadia, if we permitted people who were forced to kill others to do Birkat Kohanim, kal vachomer, that if we are sending our boys into battle to perform a mitzvah of protecting the Jewish people, of protecting the Holy Land, if they are what they are participating is in what we call a milchemet mitzvah, then kal vachomer, ben benosha kal vachomer, that they are allowed when they come back from war to perform Birkat Kohanim. I will say that this question actually came up during the Yom Kippur War. And when the boys came back from the Yom Kippur War, apparently many of them were disturbed with this question. And Rav Avadya's tshuva was apparently a very, very important tshuva, not only for the chayalim, the kohanim, that had to ask this technical question, but rather it gave a lot of comfort to many soldiers who felt obviously going to war, going to battle, coming back, being in circumstances that are very uncomfortable and very, obviously very difficult. I think that this tshuva of Rav Avadya gave comfort to the boys, telling them what you did was correct, what you did was a mitzvah, you protected the Jewish people. So I believe that this tshuva was not just about solving the technical problem of Birkat Kohanim, but it was more than that, giving them the assurance that what they were doing was correct and moral and ethical, and gave them a good feeling. I want to go back a second to First World War, where the rabbis at the time were discussing this question for the purpose of addressing the bigger question, whether or not Kohanim should go to war. Rabbi Hertz, in his tshuva at the time, Chief Rabbi Hertz argued that we find in Jewish history that Kohanim actually went to battle. Meaning, although the Torah itself told Kohanim B'nai Levi that they are exempt from going to battle, we find that in Jewish history, Kohanim were actually active in battle. The best example, of course, are B'nai Chashmonaim. During the Hanukkah campaign, the family of Matityahu and all his children were Kohanim. Yehuda HaMakabi, Matityahu, Shimon, Elazar, all the sons of Matityahu were Kohanim who went to battle, who were not just regular soldiers, but were actually the commanders, the officers, the leading forces in the Hashmonai army. Surely, says Rav Hertz, this created a precedent that proves to us that Kohanim are allowed to go to battle, are allowed to fight. So this is a very interesting precedent. And if you think about it, this is not just the first time in Jewish history that Kohanim are fighting. If you really think about it, you will notice that the Kohanim have a very interesting connection to fighting. It starts with Shimon v'Levi. Levi, Shimon's brother. The first battle, you might argue, that Am Yisrael were ever involved was the battle for Dinah in the city of Shechem in Sefer Bereshit. One could argue that this is the first time that we have a battle in Jewish history that wasn't just an individual, but rather a group of Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yaakov went to battle, and Levi was obviously the leader of the pack. Levi, being a Kohen, was involved in the killing that happened in the city of Shechem. Later on, in Chet HaEgel, when Moshe Rabbeinu calls for people to fight and kill the people who committed the Chet HaEgel, so he calls out Mila Hashem Elai, and it's Bnei Levi who come to battle. Later on, when the story of Pinchas, you all remember the story of Pinchas. Pinchas the Kohen is the first one to get up and to slay Zimri. So we see that in the Tanakh, leading up to the Chashmonai period, it was a part of the Levi tribe tradition almost to go to battle. They were a tribe that were probably used to going to battle and to fight. So it's interesting that of all tribes of Israel that are exempt from going to war, it's Dafka Shevet Levi who are exempt and have this kind of very interesting relationship with battle, with war. So if we sum up what we learned until now, it seems that although the Torah exempted Shevet Levi from. I see that. Yeah, I see some of the chats. I just want to. I will get back to some of the chats that I can see some of the. It's a bit hard. I'm sorry. Difficult as I'm giving shir to look at all the interesting observations that people are making. I will try at the corner of my eye to look at them and to relate to them as shir goes by. I'm sorry if I don't. I'm happy privately later on to address them. So if we sum up what we said until now, Shevet Levi was exempt from going to war. They were not counted in the Mifkad. When the Jews were counted in the Midbar to go to war, they were not counted. And that serves probably as an indication that they were exempt from going to war. However, in Jewish history, we find that there were Kohanim and Levim that did go to battle. And it seems that Ben Levi, that which is to volunteer to the Jewish army and to fight, is permitted, is allowed. However, the first time that we find a real discussion about this is in World War I, which brought up the question of Birkat Kohanim for a soldier who kills someone, which was a precedent for our discussion in the Yom Kippur War, when soldiers came back from the battles and were very bothered by this question. And Rav Avadya Yosef told them that they are permitted to do Birkat Kohanim. I want to mention that in Rav Herschel Schechter's book, Nefesh HaRav, which is a book describing the customs and the thoughts of Rav Soloveitchik, he mentions that the Rav was much more, was less lenient about our question, and Rav Soloveitchik challenged whether or not Israeli soldiers are permitted to do Birkat Kohanim. In his discussion, in the book Nefesh HaRav, by the way, I about Pinchas, I will mention Pinchas in a second, because I think that what people worry about Pinchas is a very valid point, and I'll get back to that. Rav Soloveitchik mentions that he's not so happy to permit Israeli soldiers that killed people in battle to do Birkat Kohanim. And in this in the context of his answer, he refers to David HaMelech, who was told by Kadosh Baruch Hu, by the Navi, that he's not allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash due to the fact that he was involved in battle, and in battle he was killing people. And therefore, according to some interpretations of those psukim, the common interpretation of those psukim are that as a result of David HaMelech being involved in battle, he is not allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash. And the Rav Soloveitchik at the time, I'm not sure he really gave a clear psak about this, but he was playing with the idea in his mind, and he mentioned this idea that there is a certain price that we pay when one goes to battle. I mentioned this because I mentioned Pinchas before. And Pinchas, we know, became a Kohen at the act of killing Zimri. But at the same time, he was given a brit shalom. And the Netziv Mivolozhin, in a very famous commentary on this pasuk, questions, why is Pinchas given a brit shalom, a covenant of peace, when the act of killing the Israelite and the whole story of the Zimri, why is he given a brit shalom? And the Netziv Mivolozhin gives a very important answer. He says that it is true that when people go to battle, when people sometimes need to kill people, Mechemet Mitzvah is a case where we demand that people do what they have to do to save people, to save the country. However, it still is a problem. When someone kills someone, there's a certain stain that it's very hard to erase. If you want a psychological stain, if you want an ethical stain, that remains with the person. The Netziv explains that is why Pinchas is given a brit shalom. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as if, tells us that if people fulfill Torah, if people are only going to do what they have to do because HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands us to do so, then they will receive the brit shalom, which means Hashem will assure them, will make sure that the stain of what they did will not affect them, will not affect their personality, their character. They will still be able to stay sensitive. They will be able to stay people that have sensitivity and to human life. And this will not turn them as if to be insensitive to human life. So this is a point which I think is very interesting. I think it's a fair point to mention that as much as we realize that battle is under certain circumstances is a correct thing to do, and for sure the Israeli wars that took place the past 72 years, we understand that we had no other choice but to go to battle and to fight our enemies. However, we know that there's a certain price to pay when we have to kill people. That really still creates a certain challenge when it comes to a Kohen and what he symbolizes. There is a similar perush of the Netziv Mivolozhin when it comes to Ir Nidachat later on in Sefer Dvarim, when the Torah tells us that under very, very extreme circumstances, the Jewish people have to destroy a city of idol worshippers. Again, the Torah promises that if we do so, we will get the blessing of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Here again explains the Netziv of Elohim that the blessing here means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will assure us that the act of killing an entire city of idol worshippers will not affect us in the negative way. Rav Yaakov Meidan, the Rosh Yeshiva of Gush, once used this idea to explain the chait, the sin of Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech was told to destroy the people of Amalek. And when he comes back from the battle, the Navi, Shmuel HaNavi, meets him and tells him off for not fulfilling exactly what God told him to do so. What did God tell him? God told him to destroy everyone, and he left the sheep. So Shmuel tells him, because of this sin, you're losing your kingship. I mean, if you think about it for a second, Shaul HaMelech loses his kingship because he did not kill all the sheep of the Amalek. The answer, says Rav Meidan, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded Shaul and the Jewish people to go to battle. And when Am Yisrael go to battle for the right reasons, then the Kadosh Baruch Hu is there to protect us, not only in battle, but he also protects us from the results of the battle. He makes sure that when we come back from battle, not only are we whole in body, but we're whole in spirit and soul. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give us Siyata Dishmaya, that the effects of war will not continue affecting the soldiers. However, what Shaul HaMelech did was against God's will. And by doing that, he did not ensure the bracha of Hashem to affect the soul of the Jewish soldiers. And for that, you lose your kingship. So that's an interesting idea that goes back to Pinchas and the idea of Kohanim going to battle. So until now, we gave one example of how the Kohen, I'm happy to look at some of the questions now. I'm sorry, I'll continue with the shiur. I'll try maybe afterwards to address some of the questions. If until now we spoke about a very specific question, which we said is more than a technical question. And the question is, what is the place of a Kohen in war when it comes to being a Tameh, being Mitameh Temetim and Birkat Kohanim? I would like to use the Kohen again as a model for a different question, which unfortunately is one of the most bothering questions in the Israeli army today. And I would actually argue that it's one of the most debatable, sensitive, emotional questions in the state of Israel today. And that is whether or not every Israeli soldier, every citizen of Israel should be drafted to the Israeli army, or should people who learn Torah and yeshiva be exempt from the Israeli army. And why do I bring this question up in the context of a Kohen? Because one of the most popular sources that those who oppose drafting in yeshiva boys use is the president of Shevet Levi. And here again, I want please everyone to look, if they can, at the source sheet, because you will see that the Rambam in the Chot Shemitah, source number one, tells us that Shevet Levi, the Kohanim, the Levi'im, do not receive a portion in the land of Israel because they are set apart from the ways of the world. If you follow me, they do not wage war like the remainder of the Jewish people. So as we said in the beginning of today's shir, Shevet Levi are exempt from going to war. However, it's the next paragraph of the Rambam which the Haredi community used today to explain why they do not have to go to the Israeli army. They quote the Rambam: not only the tribe of Levi, but any one of the inhabitants of the world whose spirit generously motivates him and he understands, etc., etc. Basically, the Rambam tells us that anyone who wishes to become like Shevet Levi, any Jew who says, I want to be cut off from this world, I want to stay in yeshiva as if all day and learn Torah, he, like the Levi, like the Kohen, is permitted to do so and does not have to serve in the army. This is one of the most famous popular sources till today that is quoted by those who argue that is that people who learn Torah and Yeshiva do not have to go to Tzahal. I want to address this source specifically because I feel that many times it is a mistake, in my opinion, my humble opinion, a mistake to use this source as a heter for Yeshiva guys to not go to the Israeli army. First of all, quoting Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein wrote an article, a very well-known article, explaining his opinion why every yeshiva boy should go to the Israeli army. To my knowledge, he was the first Rosh Yeshiva ever in the history of the world to argue that every yeshiva boy should go to the Israeli army, the lo yotzi min haklal, without any exemptions. He argued the following. He said, context is very important, especially in the Rambam. Where does this law appear? A, it appears in Hilchot Shemitah. If the Rambam really wanted to tell us that a Kohen or a yeshiva student is potter from going to the army, it should have been mentioned in Hilchot Milchama. The Rambam has a whole entire section at the end of the Rambam called Hilchot Melachim u'Milchamotehem, in which the Rambam goes through all the laws of war. And he actually mentions who is obligated to go to war and who's exempt to go to war. And in those laws, the Rambam does not mention that people who learn Torah are exempt from going to the Israeli army. That itself should serve as a very strong argument against using this as a source. Furthermore, the Rambam is quoting this not only in Hilchot Shemitah, but at the end, the last halakha of Hilchot Shemitah. And we know that the Rambam has a tendency to quote at the end of his books matters that are more of the agadic nature and not necessarily halachic. So for those two reasons of context, it really seems quite convincing that this is not a very powerful source to use why yeshiva boys should be exempt from going to war. Furthermore, if you go back to the sheet, you will see that Rav Drukman has in his hands a manuscript, which is not, which if not mistaken, just a few years ago was published for the first time. In it, he quotes a manuscript of Rav Kook, who argued in source number two, V'nire de'afapi she'en shevet levi olchim milchama, hay la'asot milchama pashtit. However, k'shekol Yisrael yotzim la'milchama, mechuyavim hem latzet. Rav Kook explicitly wrote that the even if you want to use this Rambam as a source, this was referring to tribal wars. But when the whole entire Jewish people are at war, no one exempt. Shevet Levi is not exempt to go to war when all are required, when there is a Melchemet Mitzvah out there, even Shevet Levi have to go to war. So it would seem that for many reasons, this Rambam cannot serve as a source for people learning Torah to be exempt from going to the army. And according to what we just said now, it can't even serve as a source for Shevet Levi for not going to war. However, I would like to add one more insight, which I think is vital to our discussion today. And in some way, it may summarize all what was discussed today. I started or mentioned during the Shi'ur that we find a great paradox that although the Kohanim and the Levi'im have a halachic problem and maybe even a spiritual problem of fighting, we find the exact opposite. We find that it was very hard to keep the priests, the Kohanim, the Levi'im, out of battle. We just mentioned Levi and Pinchas and Shevet Levi and the Chashmonaim. And we mentioned that during Jewish history, Kohanim, Levim did fight in battle. So we find this great paradox. And on one hand, it's as if against the nature, the halachic nature and the spirit nature of a Kohen to go to battle. But de facto, we find that Kohanim, Levim did fight in battle. What is the meaning of this dissonance between the as if Torah shebichtav that tells us not to, and the Torah shebaal peh, which is basically telling us that Kohanim are actually able to fight in war? I believe that the following insight is what's happening here. In order to explain this idea, I want to tell a story about my father, who was a Rebbe in Gush for many, many years. Many of you are familiar with Yeshivat HaRetzion, which is a Hesder Yeshiva. And my father, since 1979, until he passed away, was a Rebbe in a Yeshiva. He taught Israeli boys who used to combine their army service together with serious, intense Torah learning. And my father told me that somewhere in the 80s, a group of French government representatives came to Israel, and they were interested in, they heard about this model of an institution that combines Torah learning and army service. And they were very interested in such a model. And they came to the yeshiva. My father told me they came to the Bet Midrash, and they walked around the Bet Midrash, and lo and behold, they see these guys sitting in a Bet Midrash learning Gemara. And the guys are sitting with shtenders or whatever, learning their Gemara. and these French representatives of the French government are walking around them, and they're being introduced to them, and they're being told, oh, these two guys, this guy was an officer in the tanks, and this guy fought in Lebanon, this guy fought in this war, and this guy is an officer here, and this guy's a paratrooper, and this... They walk through the Bet Midrash, and when they finish the tour, they turn to the Rabbeim, and they told them, good try, but we don't believe you. We don't believe that these guys are soldiers. They're way too sensitive and scholarly to be soldiers. And they said, what do you mean? They said, we live in France, and we know what an army is. The French army, most of the guys, they can't read or write. What do you mean? They're learning Aramaic studies. They're learning philosophy. They're learning Talmud. They're learning manuscripts. I mean, what are you talking about? This is unheard of. I mean, they could understand. How is it possible? How is it possible that a person who's studying such a text is in battle? And it really highlighted this most amazing model of what we're trying to achieve here in Israel. And I think what we're trying to achieve here is a model which goes back to the story of Yitzchak with Yaakov and Esav. And I'll explain. When Yitzchak gave the bracha, or tried to give the bracha to Esav, he was very, very, he was put in a very, very difficult position, because according to the way Rabbi Yoel ben Nun explains, Yitzchak's dilemma, he realized that the Jewish people at the time need a strong leader to begin a Jewish nation. And Esav was a stronger leader. And even though Esav may have been problematic in many of his actions, he was a strong leader. While Yaakov, the young yeshiva boy who was sitting in a tent all day learning, Yitzchak did not believe that he was able to really build the Jewish people. However, when Yaakov dresses up as Esav and walks into the tent, covering his hands with fur, Yitzchak responds the following. He says, Hakol kol Yaakov vehayadayim midei Esav. Aha, says Yitzchak, this is the combination. This is what I'm looking for. I am looking for a Jewish leader who will have the voice of Yaakov, who will be sensitive, who will be kind, but at the same time will have the hands of Esav, who will be able to go to battle, and at time of battle will be fierce and will destroy his enemies, but at the same time will have the voice of Yaakov, will be kind, will be sensitive, will be someone who life is precious to him and will not be affected by the battles. This model of Yadayim Yidei Esav V'Hakol Kol Yaakov, in my opinion, is the model of what the Hesder Yeshivot were trying and are trying to create, a model of combining these two personalities into one. And therefore, I sense that although the Torah as if is telling us that a Kohen is exempt, and nevertheless it was the Kohanim who went to battle all the time, it's because that's exactly what we want to create. We want the Kohen in some ironic way to be the one in battle. And therefore, using this idea, I personally want to argue, and everyone can voice their opinion and their thoughts about this. In my opinion, it is the yeshiva boys who should be the first ones in battle, because it is the yeshiva boys who we want them to bring with them the call of Yaakov to the battlefields. We didn't come back to build just another army like any other country. We, Baruch Hashem, are proud to have a Tzahal who is moral, a Tzahal who's ethical, a Tzahal which always is sensitive to have that very delicate balance between Akol Kol Yaakov Ve'adayim De Esav. So surely it is the people who learn Torah, who are aware of this delicate combination, who should be the first ones going to war, and not chas v'sholom, the exact opposite of staying behind. And therefore, to sum up what we just said now, if I started today with a delicate, sensitive question, which gave us a bit of an opening, an insight to the questions that come up in the modern Israeli army regarding a Kohen who is a fighter in the Israeli army, to whether or not it is a problem for him to be a fighter, we ended up with the conclusion that it is the place of Kohanim, it is the place of Bnei Torah, it is the place of Bnei Yeshiva to be in the front lines of the Israeli army. Unfortunately, many of those Bnei Torah, many Bnei Yeshiva have paid the ultimate price for this and fighting in the Israeli army. We have many who were killed in the Israeli wars. But I believe that should be the model, and that should be the idea of what the Kohanim stand for. Kol Kol Yaakov Aydaim De Esav. This should be some kind of model for Bnei Yeshiva, Bnei Torah, to be the first ones going into the Israeli army and fighting for the Jewish people. Thank you very much for today's shiur, and thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you, Torah in Motion, and I look forward in meeting you all next week. We will continue the series of shiurim talking about dilemmas of an Israeli state.
Rabbi, do you want to address any of the questions in the chat box now?
Okay, I will try.
As you know, I was at chat part of the time, so I didn't follow. Right. I didn't see all of it. You can take a quick look. While you do that, I just invite everybody this evening, Rabbi Chaim Schaffner, the rabbi of Kesher Israel Synagogue in Washington, D.C., will be giving a Parshat HaShavua Shir on Kedoshim. It's Zachar Monday and Kedoshim. He's talking on Kedoshim, considered by Rashi, I guess, the most important Parsha in the Chumash. And everybody's invited. That's 8:30 of our rotating Parsha Shir. I'll be giving a Pirkei Avot Shir 9:30 tomorrow morning, our Friday morning Shir. And on Sunday morning, Rabbi Adam Mintz will be beginning his series on Second Temple history a little bit. Very, very interesting. You see the topics will be posted online. We have a whole bunch of two more series of shirim starting next week. So I want to wish everybody well, wish everybody healthy, and we're interested in your feedback, comment, and suggestions, anything I have to say, and we appreciate your coming. And now Rabbi Tabori probably had a chance to look over the chat box. Thank you very much.
I saw that people were very interested in the question whether or not Pinchas and Moshe, Aaron, were they really Kohanim, Levim? Was Pinchas really a Kohen? So people are correct with their observations that this is discussed by the Mefarshim. At what point did Pinchas become a Kohen? Was Moshe, at what point were there Levim and Kohanim? I agree that all that is correct. However, I do not use Pinchas and Moshe and Aaron as a halachic source, meaning I'm less interested in whether or not they were really Kohanim, really Levim. What I meant when I mentioned them is to show that Shevet Levi as a whole, the tribe of Levi, the tribe that do become de facto, they become Kohanim, they become Levim. It's as if in their nature, we see that in their DNA, as if even before maybe they became officially priests, it's in their DNA to go to battle, to fight. Even Levi, obviously, Levi, as I mentioned in Shechem, was not a Kohen at that point. And yet, the idea was to prove that Shevet Levi throughout the Tanakh were people who were naturally the ones who felt very comfortable in going to war. That was my point of mentioning them. I'm less interested at this point whether or not they were officially Kohanim or Levim. Rabbi Kelman.
Yeah, I'm just, if you went through all the chat, that's fine. We'll let you go. Wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Be well. And I appreciate your quoting your father, as you know, of course, was my Rosh Yeshiva for my 4 years in high school in Toronto. Really a wonderful model, a wonderful teacher. And, it's a pleasure to have the next generation with us also. So should all be well, and let's learn together. And we'll see you. Look forward to seeing everybody for many of this year. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful
Thank you, everyone. Call two.